Music makes people come together at festivals, gigs and clubs. We share epic moments. Best friends for the entire set or the rest of our lives. Heineken, live your music. To get your hands on tickets to all the best gigs and festivals, visit heinekenmusic.ie. Enjoy Heineken responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie.
Hello, I'm Roisin Murphy. This is The Sync Sessions, brought to you by Heineken Live Your Music. I'll be speaking to some fantastic musicians and artists over the course of the next few months. And yeah, it's a privilege really to be here and be talking to such clever and wonderfully modest, in the most cases, people. And we have the kinds of conversations that you don't necessarily have with journalists. It's more like intimate than that. In every episode, I'm going to be speaking to different guests with different stories, people who've gone on different kinds of musical journeys, and some very surprising journeys as well. People you wouldn't expect, say, to be into rave or Public Enemy. Some shocking kind of revelations, I guess. And their journeys and the people that they've met along the way, incredible artists that they've worked with, kind of sharing the ways in which music has helped shape not just our music, but our lives and our identities. So it's wonderful to have one half of Groove Armada here in the studio with us.
Wonderful to be here.
Tom Finlay.
That's me.
And he's so handsome in the flesh, guys. You wouldn't believe. Fabulous tan.
That's what I've got. That's it's the tan, you see. It's just very good for
me. Why do you have a tan? Where do you live?
Because the summers is just busy for me with all the gigging and that. But then my wife, bless her, insists on quite a lot of holidays to break up the gigs. So I've had a week in Ischia, which is off the bay of Naples down there, which has been
beautiful.
Amazing. Which is perfect. And then we had a week in Norfolk in that middle of that mad heatwave thing.
Yes.
So that was nuts. You never expect to get a tan in Norfolk. And no. I've just been topping up at various festivals during the summer.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. You're marvellous.
Yeah,
you're like a Greek god here.
So kind of you to say, Tom. I would be blushing if I wasn't so brown.
So you did a DJ gig last night.
Yep.
Are you still doing a lot of DJ? Do you DJ consistently throughout the year or just in the summertime? Or?
No, I mean, we're doing like, because we've now sort of got to that stage in our lives where, you know, we're doing other stuff, you know. So Andy's like, and lots have been talked about, but he's now into all this farming thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he's horning in the harvest right now.
And you're training to
and
be?
And I'm training to be a cognitive behavioural therapist.
How amazing.
Yeah, so that works really well because I study, you know, my college work is like September to like May.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I get all that done, do all my essays, do all my counselling, and then come May, we kick off again and start doing the festival. So I don't really want to do the club circuit thing anymore. That doesn't feel where I want to be. If I'm standing there surrounded by loads of 18-year-olds, it just doesn't feel right anymore.
Yes,
I just
yeah.
feel like
and
this is not an environment I should be in.
And you have to sort of have a drink and you have
yeah,
to be up all night.
And all that. But the festival scene I love. So we're coming from May when it all kicks off, and then we run through till September, October. Lots of Ibiza still.
Yes.
Which is, you know, a big part of our lives. A bit sort of, you know, wrote a lot of our first few songs in Ibiza. So
yes,
it's always nice to go back there, although it's sort of changed beyond recognition from where
it
I
has.
Remember
it. I wanted to talk about Ibiza with you, but I was going to wait till we spoke about the Chris Rea track that
oh,
you
yeah.
chose. So
that's
we'll
cool.
Do
we
that.
Can wait.
So, do you DJ alone or always together, you guys?
No, I mean, we do quite a bit of different stuff. I mean, I tend to play a little bit on my own. I do a radio show, and it's a sort of, and I grew up really with sort of soul and funk as my thing. I come from Cambridge, and for whatever reason, I think it was maybe its connection to, there was a record shop there called Fat Max's. It was like the only record shop in Cambridge, and all he sold was soul and funk, and it kind of influenced a whole generation of people. So
yeah.
So when I go out on my own, I get to kind of tick, you know, it sort of scratch that itch of like playing funk and disco and edits, and that whole scene's having like a massive revival, you know, like with the whole Glitterbox thing. So I do that on my own, and that's
yes.
great. And then when it's me and Andy, it's a bit more of a housey thing, you
yeah.
know. And it's fun when we do it together. We do the lighting and we've got all these sort of sound effects going on. It's a bit more of a show. And when I'm on my own, it's a lot looser.
Yes, yeah.
yeah.
So would you consider yourself, you were a soul boy first then? Or
100%, yeah. I mean, I was quite dismissive of house music when I was 16 and 17.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't cool. It was a bit, you know, anything that was like with a synchronised, the sequence beat, we all thought was a bit naff, you know?
What era is that? What days
so,
would
yeah,
that be?
So, yeah, kind of late 80s. And I would have been sort of, you know, that's when I started DJing like parties for friends, and that was all funk records, funk and
that's before you went to university.
Yeah, and then I went to university in Manchester. And then I started actually doing parties. I ran a couple of my own nights. It was called Bad Bad Simba, which is named after one of my favourite records by a guy called O'Donnell Levy. We could add that to the podcast list one day.
You could, yeah.
But it's a wild kind of jazz guitar record, you know, and that was my sort of signature tune. Mm-hmm.
So was that a jazz funk night then?
That was a jazz funk night, yeah. You paid £1 and you got free veg chili and 3 hours of me playing jazz funk. So that's a good deal. I guess when we're going back to thinking about when I realised that I might like house music, which when I was being 16, 17 and being a bit difficult.
Yes.
Was somebody dropped Back to My Roots by Richie Havens, and he does a cover of it. And it's kind of like, you know, the FBI project, the Atow House version by Back to My Roots. We all knew, I think he's, you know, Richie in Paradise one. But that sort of, it predates that version, but it's the same vibe. And that was definitely my moment when I thought that was a life changing. I can remember where I was, I can remember the experience, the time, I can remember everything about that moment when that record dropped. I was 17, I can remember it like it was yesterday.
But that's not a house record.
It's not a house record, but the vibe is there, the piano breakdown, and, you know, the lyric and the sense of positivity. They're not kind of complicated lyrics, the togetherness, the whole thing. It's sort of, stylistically it's not, but, you know, I play it in DJ sets when I'm in the middle of a house set and it sits
and do you put any beat under it or
no,
just play it as
no,
it is?
No, it's so well produced, that record. Yes. You get away with it. You do a little edit. Find some way of getting yourself out of it. But you can, because that piano thing is just so universal and it's such a night, and that's probably a proper piano.
Yes.
You know, rather than some Korg thing in the studio. It sounds fat, you know. So, yeah, now that tune still totally stands up. You get away with that.
Yeah. Talking about people who have worked with and you're into, but I heard that Prince even shouted out you guys from stage once. How did that feel?
That was just odd. I mean, it was actually like, I definitely didn't know we were there, but it was when he did a series of gigs in the O2 about 5 years ago, and he did it in the round there in the O2. So he was right in the bass. Then we, I don't know how we got it, but we got the most amount, like front of house seats. I just bought them, I don't know, but anyway, we got these perfect seats. And there was just some girl, and he just shouted out, "I see you, baby," to this girl who was at the thing. And everyone started shouting. I was thinking, oh my God, this, like, my whole world's have come together. This is like a perfect moment for me.
Incredible.
Somehow I've passed into his consciousness in some small way. And it felt great. We did a couple of gigs with him, and he had a bar somewhere in, or had a place up in, it's called the Ruby Lounge in San Francisco. And there was a little bit where we played a couple of nights in a row. And every night everyone was saying, he's going to come down. But he never came down.
He never came.
Yeah. We had a similar experience with Madonna, but she did eventually come.
Oh, yeah, I remember you guys talking about doing something with Madonna
years ago. We
wrote
a track
with
her years and years ago, and we were in Andy's flat in Brick Lane. It was a bit of a scruffy old flat, you know, and it was spiff everywhere. And they kept saying to us, you know, she was going to come round. So I'd get up in the morning, I'd do the hoovering, make it all look nice. But yeah, she never made it. We did get the track done, though.
How did you get the track done?
How?
Yeah, where?
It was done. It was more of a remix. It was a track first called Music, and that was, we really, really went to town with that one, and we did the whole strings thing and threw the kitchen sink at it. I love the version, but it's one of the ones where, you know, you love it, and they didn't love it so much, but they released it.
They released it. Great.
Yeah, so that was something. Yeah.
And so did you get to hang out with her at all?
No,
never met her at all.
No, because we had that whole bit, you know, where there's that bit when you first, I guess, you have that little moment in a real ferment, don't you, as an artist, when you break out and everyone's name checking you. So we had just had that little year when Madonna was talking to Elton about Groove Armada, you know. But you have that little period, and it's fun.
Yeah.
But you just don't want to get too caught up in all that stuff because it's exhausting, you know.
Yeah. Let's talk about the labels that you've been on. This first label
was Tummy Touch.
Which was classic. It was legendary.
Yeah, it's a great label.
London label.
That's the start of, and that's where the Idiot Boys and a lot of the bands that, so I said, all the sort of people that I, you know, guys that came from Cambridge, there's basically them and Harvey, and they're all been in and out of that label. Yeah. So that was us.
Is it still going, the label?
It is, amazingly. Yeah. They release, and he lives out in New York now, Tim, and he's got quite into the kind of, you know, supply music, all the kind of library stuff, got quite sophisticated with it.
He
was a great musician in his own right as well. But so that label was the start of everything.
And then where did you go?
Well, then Rob DeBank, of course, who runs Best of All, he sort of picked up on At the River, made it some DJ Mag Tune of the Month, and then very quickly, that's a funny thing, like, I guess in those days, again, there was a sort of small cabal of, like, A&R men, particularly in dance music.
Yes.
You could probably name the 10 of them that were making or breaking careers. It wasn't like, you know, it was really sort of it felt easy to me to get a record deal at that time. Like, if you knew
I think it was easy.
And you hung with the right people and you did the right thing. It felt to me, us getting a record deal felt like this was always going to happen.
But there wasn't billions of people doing
it. No, and that was the thing. When we made our first album, there weren't people, you know, there was no one even making dance records, you know, like actually trying to make an album. So that felt, yeah, that got picked up by Pepper, which is now Jive. And so our, you know, we were signed to, our label stablemates were Steps.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's who's on.
But Jive's had some great people on
it,
hasn't
it? Yeah, they did. Yeah, I mean, so they had a great sort of soul background and stuff as well. But yeah. So that Jive's where it started. And
that gave you some kind of traction in America, did it?
Yeah, it did to some extent. I mean, America is one of those places where I think if you want to make a success of it, you have to commit to it, like, completely, you know. And they want every bit of you. You go over there and they're like, you're going to have to come for 6 months. And I'm like, well, I can't do that. I've got, like, a young family. And if you don't, they sort of spit you out. I mean, an example of who was on the label at us at the same time was Dido. Mm-hmm. And she just came out of there and she lived there for 8 years and she's toured that place relentlessly, you know, until it broke. And then when you break, you know, the riches are there for everyone. But we weren't prepared to kind of change our life. And they're quite like that, at least that label I dealt with. It's either like, if you're in, you're in, and we love you. And if you're not totally playing the game our way, then you might just, you're dead to us.
So is that how it was on Jive for you? Did you get dropped?
The spirit of being in America was like that, yeah. So we're going out there. We'd done ICU, Baby, and that had been a hit in the UK.
Yeah.
Quite a weird version of it, going back in it. And then Fatboy Slim was in his absolute pomp. He was, like, making tons of money. He did a remix of that, which went stellar.
In the US.
Well, stellar, and he was big there, and they picked that up. And I just remember sort of driving around in the back of this limousine, talking about the number of ads they had, and going to these amazing places to do interviews with the oddest people in these crazy little towns. Mm. And all the time just thinking, I don't want to be doing this. This is not why I got into this business, you know, and just feeling quite not unhappy, but just feeling like this wasn't part of the plan,
right?
And I think Andy felt the same way. And I thought, I'm not going to do this for a year, going in and out of radio stations talking about the same record that I didn't even mix, you know, Fatboy's version. So that was the stuff that I've always loved. You know, I've loved being out with the band. That's the stuff that I love. Those experiences about being around like-minded people, having great experiences, playing to audiences, you know, I love all that, but all the waffle and all the stuff that goes in between. I mean, this is lovely. Don't
did
get
you
me
ever
wrong,
have? But, did you ever have, but, like, you know, arguments with labels and things like that? Do you have difficulties at all?
I'm a very non-confrontational person, so I should have had more, and I should have stood my ground more. I should have done that more, and I should have been clearer. But I think we ended up almost just like we weren't really prepared to play the game. And you know what labels like when you do that? You just turn off you until, like, nobody's really answering
the
phone anymore. It hurts
the first few times it happens, but then you get used to it. You say, "Oh, well."
It's tough. I remember we did an album called Love Box, which is the one that's the festival's named after, and I remember touring that album. That was our nadir with Jive. Things were, like, really bad then. Like, no one was even speaking to us from the label.
Yeah.
I mean, I was going to gigs in, like, where the album was out in Nottingham. I remember doing this, and there was no records in the shops. I mean, like, they just cut you off, you know. And you spent a year, we sat in a really small, sweaty studio on Curtin Road, and mainly in our underpants because it was so hot, that studio, eating every pizza off the Pizza Express menu about five times over, and you're there for, like, a year. And, you know, it was a nice album. That had Richie. That was one that had Richie Havens on it. And Nena. It was... They couldn't be bothered. There wasn't a single, so they couldn't be bothered.
How awful. Yeah. Isn't it terrible?
Yeah.
And it's shocking the first couple of times
it is, yeah.
Because you're kind of led to believe that the industry is paternal.
Yeah.
Or that they're there to take care of you, that they're going to take care of you, but it's not true at all.
And you meet lovely people along the way. So you meet people who are like, you know, exceptions to that rule, you know, and it's great when
obviously,
you do.
Yeah.
And you remember them, but then most of them, certainly in my experience, were less like that, you know.
Yeah. No, and then, so where did you go next? How did you release next?
So then we sort of, that was sort of one of those moments where we came to, I talked about earlier, where you were thinking, maybe this is it, you know? And then it was actually the festival that revived it all, you know, because then we'd done the album Love Boss. A pal of ours rung us up and said, oh, I've got rights to Clapham Common, you know, do you want to do a gig there? I said, well, we might as well just name it after the album, get a bit of coverage for that. And so we did that.
Just did a straight up gig?
Just one off gig. We had Norman Jay warm me up. It was the same weekend as Glastonbury. Mm-hmm. One stage. Mm-hmm. No, one stage, and then Tim playing it. So one main stage and a funk stage. So 20,000 tickets overnight for the festival, which
Fantastic.
Has never been like that before. I think because we weren't doing many gigs in London. And that sort of suddenly just felt, everything felt good again. So you're back in touch with the things that really mattered to you, you know? And then that gave birth to the festival. And then the festival just being around, like I said, I'm an audiophile, like being around good music again. I just restored my faith in the whole process until that eventually went sour.
Kind of DJing on a bigger scale.
Yeah,
really.
It was great. I mean, running a festival, the first two or three years were like amazing. When you got to work against the system, because there's a system around festivals as well.
Oh, I'm sure.
It's massive. And, you know, and there's a certain, you know, you want to try and book a big artist, but, you know, there's exclusivity deals left, right and centre, and you're trying to find mavericks that will come and work with you. Those first 2-3 years running the festival were some of the funnest years of my life.
In terms of,
yeah, and then it just got too big.
As well, yeah.
And then it stopped being fun. But,
and then what did you do? You sold that then?
So we sort of had to sell it because we lost so much money. Mm-hmm. Every year we'd lose more and more money. And then eventually, every time you lose money, then somebody puts money in and you lose more and more equity. And so I think we had about 20% left of the company.
Yeah.
And it's in your name and it's not being run the way you want it to be run, you know.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it felt the right thing to go.
It's still going though, isn't it?
It's still going. And actually, I like this incarnation of it now.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's they've gone much more. It's like a kind of much more younger sort of vibe. They had who was headlining this year? It was what's his name? We'll come back to me. We'll come back to me in a senior moment. But then it's got more of an R&B. They had Frank Ocean last year.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think they're doing a really good job with it. But it's all part of Live Nation. It's all done with the same people that own all those other festivals. So
right, I had a good night there in the Horsemeat Disco.
Yeah, well, that's amazing.
Area.
Well, that's a great example of something for us. Like, so when we, you know, when it was at its pomp, we brought in and we had a, you know, for want of a better, we had a gay day on the Sunday.
Yes.
And it was our first sort of, you know, that was the idea. It was informed by where we lived in Dalston.
I think that's the day I went.
Yeah, and we've thought, you know, I was aware of Horsemeat Disco, but we worked a lot with Dan Beaumont, who did Disco Bloodbath, and that's one of the things I'm more proud of, actually, is sort of involvement in bringing sort of, not that I'm saying I brought gay culture into the mainstream, but that it was part of that process of people like that.
Well, that was the first time I saw it to that extent in a festival. And now Glastonbury does something very similar.
Yeah. Yeah.
With Block 9.
Yeah, exactly.
And a very similar atmosphere, actually.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
I walked in there and the sweat.
I know.
And
the it's that biblical, isn't it? I know.
And
it's
the
overwhelming.
Oh, it was just absolutely wonderful.
But they were great. Yeah, I mean, we had that one year when we said we heard Grace Jones headlining that day.
Yes.
And that was like as perfect a weekend. We had Dizzy on the Friday, we had Roxy Music on the Saturday, and we had Grace Jones on the Sunday.
Well, how could you get any better than that?
No, that was amazing. Really? And that was when, you know, and then when I met, because that's, I'd been caught in Brian Ferry for ages and ages.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean, love? But I'm just trying to get him to do it because they're one of my favourite bands. And that's the only way you can get these guys to do it. It's a process. You know, you have to sort of, you have to break them down. You have to sell the idea to them and why you'd love them to do it. And that's how we end up working. He does a track with us on Black Light. So
amazing.
I got to about 6 months to hang out with the chicest, suavest man in the UK.
Apparently he comes from a set of tramps.
Yeah.
But he's still very chic.
Very chic. Yeah, he looks amazing.
Don't know if we can keep that in. I heard.
No, but he's a super chic. And he was actually there was a little period when he was writing an album. And he used to invite me into the studio, you know, and he'd put all these tracks up and line all his head, all like Nile Rodgers playing all the sessions on it, you know,
incredible.
80 or 90 tracks going. And I was thinking, why are you asking me? Like, what with Brian Eno? Why do you care what I think about this album? Anyway, but it was amazing time just to sort of hang out with him and do that. And then him doing the track. And he's very studied and he takes so long to do anything. You get like 3 phone calls a week saying, Brian's thinking about it, he's got an idea. But actually what he delivered is peak Ferry. It's like a perfect moment
wonderful,
for us. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And so did he come in and do it pretty quick in
no,
the end?
No, we sent him the track and then we didn't do anything with him. He just does it all in his own studio.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Jesmond Studios, which is where he grew up in Newcastle.
Right.
And he had a kind of, like a producer, he was called, his name will come to me as well, Johnson, one named Johnson. He was our sort of middleman between us and Ferry. And Johnson was fun and a bon vivant in every way, you know. And so Johnson would just send us little missives from the Ferry camp that things are happening, you know. Ferry was stirring. But it took about 6 months, but what we got was perfect, you know.
Wonderful.
Like, absolutely perfect. I couldn't have been any better.
Do you think that's your peak then, your peak
It's one
moment.
Of the peaks. So like
Come
working
on,
with
give
those
us
sort
another,
of
give us another,
yeah,
give us another.
Well, I mean, I guess the other ones for me, in a sort of weird way, was working with Nile Rodgers, which he worked on our second album, only because this was sort of before the whole chic revivalism we're right in the middle of now, you know, and that was sort of just to get, he was a real hero of mine in that rhythm section, which is Barnard Edwards on bass. When I'm a terrible bass player, but I always, in my dreams, I was Barnard Edwards, you know, and there was Nile Rodgers and Tony Thompson, the drummer. They're the best rhythm section of all time, you know, for me. And so to work with him was amazing. We lived in a studio in Oxfordshire called Lazy Moon. We sort of isolated ourselves for like a year. It was owned by a guy called Kenny Young, who's still around, who wrote Under the Boardwalk. And so he had this amazing studio. And then, there was no mobile phones then. So I used to go to a payphone and ring up Nile, and he would just say things to me down the phone, like kind of, just sort of things you've got to go with your heart and just believe in it. But I'd be like, yeah, but have you got the guitar part ready yet? And it took ages and ages for me to finally get a bit of him. But when we got just a bit of him playing guitar on its own and adapt, you know, that was amazing.
Yeah.
And the same thing with that album with Richie Havens, who was like a real, I said earlier, they're going back to my roots, he was a real hero of mine. And his voice is so thick and amazing that just hearing his voice on a... And then playing with him on Jules, doing later with him, with a proper band, with a horn section. That still makes me... So that's actually what makes me feel quite emotional, because we tour with him, you know, we gig with him, and you know, he was a big influence on us, and, you know, so, yeah, playing with him was an amazing thing.
And an absolute gent, I bet.
Yeah, the nicest man. And sort of, in a way, like, we live in these sort of times now, and this whole sort of, you know, that sort of Trump era of trying to divide us. He was just this guy, you know, came to prominence at Woodstock in 68, what you think is like a folk festival, and... He wouldn't really say where he was from. I couldn't tell you where he grew up. He was just this guy, you know, like, and he played, you know, he played some funk stuff. I got back to my roots, but he did Beatles covers and he all made it his own. And
such a
nice guy to travel with. He had this sort of slightly sort of naughty Marlboro habit, but his manager didn't let him do it. So he used to sneak the Marlboros in his cowboy boots. And every time she left, he'd have a little sneaky cigarette and pop them back in. But obviously you could smell it on him, but it was just great. It's like 70 still doing that.
Oh, bless.
Amazing guy.
It's nice to talk to other artists about things.
It's just sort of nice. It's good. I think it's good at certain times in your life to just look back and reflect on things sometimes. So you don't. It's not a good thing to overly indulge in that. But actually, when just talking about Richie, I got really quite emotional. It's just like thinking about him again and that gig. It's a bit much. But there's good. There's really nice footage of that gig, actually. You know, and it's me playing bass, oddly. I've got one of my rare moments where Andy let me play bass, so it's really nice. I'm
Andy
there.
Let me play bass.
But he normally plays it, you see. That's his instrument as well, isn't it? And he's much better than me, so I very rarely get a chance. But I think he's on keys, and so I got a chance to play. And so just being in that room, you know, we're like... with Jules and all that stuff. You must have done it a few times.
Beautiful.
Have you done later? You must have done
it. Oh, yeah, I did a few times,
It's just fun and you're in that little round. And
it's
all
scary. It's the scariest thing to
do. And they start jamming and you're like... But there's something quite magical about that show.
There is something very petrifying about it also for me personally. I don't think I've ever done my best.
Yeah.
Nowadays, I don't know, I've got a bit older now and I was talking about this earlier, but I used to hate to hear myself talking.
I wouldn't be able to go back and listen to this.
The amount of shyness that I got through over the years that I've kind of left to the side now.
Yeah.
But every time it comes to do something, used to be come to do something big like Jules Holland or whatever.
Yeah.
It would always be... I wish I wasn't so frightened now when I have to look back on it. But then again, it's easier now because the people watching is about 5% of the people watching than there used to be. The whole country was watching in the old days.
True. It's funny, a particular personality, isn't it? Like Andy just seems to be absolutely nerveless. Like the idea for me, like you know, what you go through, but like same thing, when I see him when he gets up there and he's got the trombone and he's got to play Out the River, I think, God, I would fall apart if I had to do. it's just, I don't know how you guys do it, really.
Here I am, Roisin Murphy, and you're listening to The Sync Sessions, brought to you by Heineken, Live Your Music. So with everybody we're talking to on these podcasts, we're going to be doing a little Spotify Spotify playlist, or the artists are going to give me 10 tracks that should be on my Spotify. And we're going to talk about some of your choices now. Let's talk about someone I really admire, Sylvester. You've chosen one of his tracks. What track have you chosen?
Yeah, I mean, he's amazing. Actually, if people want to listen, an amazing documentary about him. It's on one of the iPlayers or something. You should look up. But it's about his background and where he came from, being a gay black man in the 70s and just such a strange time for him and the start of disco. And he's just a really amazing character. You know, and obviously now everyone knows him for like I Feel Mighty Real and that kind of high concept disco thing, which is brilliant. And I love that style and it's kind of crazy, but I love that delivery. But actually the track I picked of his is a track called Over and Over, which is when he was a bit more like a funk guy, you know, and even the look is less sort of obviously.
Is this before the
this
disco?
This is pre I Feel Mighty Real,
the high energy disco.
It's roarer and it's horns and it's drums. And you were saying about when I go out solo and I do my gigs, you know, when you're a DJ, there are certain, you know, those get out of jail tunes that just, you know, if everything's going tits up, you just put that on, everything will just reset.
Yes.
And Over and Over is just one of those tunes, you know, it's just a really wonderful, it's loose, you know, it's like a proper funk track, but I've honestly never played that without, enjoying playing it. And, you know, so much about DJing is obviously providing entertainment. But if you can just do a little bit of education and bring something new to people, then it's even better. I don't so many people know that record. And if you drop a bit of funk like that in the middle of a set, and it's a great record. There's loads of amazing edits of it around. There's a great Con edit at the moment that's out. But the original is one of my favourite funk trackers of all time. Yeah.
Let's just talk about DJing again for a second and the difference between DJing to 100 people and 3,000.
Yeah.
Tell me.
It's really hard, you know. I mean, I personally, and I think it's just where I'm sure probably 99% of DJs speak, or 90% would say they probably would rather that experience, you know, the 100 people, the real sense of communion about looking people in the eyes. And
you do your own party, usually that is,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's exactly like that. And you feel an energy in the room and, you know, like, so I would always rather do that. But there's something can be really exciting about delivering those big gigs, you know.
Yeah.
But it's about understanding how
demanding are the audience? That's the question.
Yeah, and you've got to, you know, you've got to amplify everything. That's the way to sort of think about it. You know, when you play those records out there over and over, and it's really intimate and human, like, say, like playing in a living room. And I think when you play on those big things, you just got to give everything a bit of a grander scale, you know.
Yeah.
So you've got to throw lighting and drama and moments and all that stuff. And something that Andy does incredibly well, mainly again because of his official giant status, he's got a very good straight arm point.
Yes.
And I say to him, like, how do you do
Come
it?
Come on, yeah. Pit off.
Exactly. And I always feel a bit ridiculous in those moments. You know, that whole kind of EDM, you know, those guys who get on, you know, who's that guy who gets on a light dinghy and surfs across the crowd, all that sort of, like, you know, I'm almost like, God, I can't believe you do all that stuff. But it sort of works, you know. At the same time, you have to admit, through gritted teeth. Someone like Guetta, you know, like, I do admire him, actually. Like, I've seen him from when he first started, when he was just coming up, and technically he's a very gifted DJ. I remember watching him right at the beginning thinking, oh, no, you're quite good. And I quite admire the fact that he can just pull this thing off and just look for all the world. Like, when he's there, this is the only place he wants to be.
Yeah.
And he's the only place he wants to be. To be able to pull off that trick time and time again, I have a huge amount of respect for it.
I'll tell you a story. I met Giorgio Moroder a few years ago. He called me to perhaps go and work on a record he was doing. And so I was in Paris and went for lunch with him, and he couldn't stop talking about David Guetta.
Right.
Can you imagine, like, that?
He's fascinated by him.
This was why he was coming back.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it was as simple as that. It was like, and it's selling records again, you know. Disco is, he lived obviously through.
Yeah.
The death of disco, you know, the burning of the records and all that. And,
and it's funny, isn't it? Because his productions are so, you know, they're still timelessly brilliant.
Unbelievable.
So it's surprising that somebody, you know, is fascinated by someone who wrote Titanium, isn't it?
Really? Yeah, I mean, it was like, and I was just confused.
But I can understand
honestly.
That in the sense of, like, maybe that, I mean, I don't know, because obviously I wasn't around in that moment when he was writing all that Donna Summer stuff, but maybe that, you know, he was probably at the absolute apex of that cultural moment. And in a sense, Guetta is now, you know, in terms
That's
of...
That's what I think the connection was.
Yeah, I get that.
But one is making something sublime.
Sure.
Yeah. And then the other is not, really.
I totally get the point.
So where he sees the connection is hard for me to understand.
Yeah.
And the music sounded like that when it came to me, and that was, I couldn't do it,
exactly.
You know, Giorgio Moroder or Giorgio Moroder.
No, exactly.
Obviously, it probably wasn't even him that was doing the music. It was,
but again,
like,
it
some
goes
guy
back to, like, what you can achieve and what was available at the time. You know, when he did that Donna Summer stuff, you know, that's probably what, you know, the fact that was the gear he had.
Had in front of him.
And a live
you
drum
wondered,
kit.
I did wonder how much of it was serendipity afterwards, but it can't be, because the more I listen to it is.
Yeah.
But I also think there's a lot to be said for Donna Summer.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Like
yeah.
that she drove a lot of that, more than you would expect.
They say with Loves to Love You Baby, because she was quite religious apparently, but that Loves to Love You Baby has all that kind of the sighing and the groaning. Apparently she had to do that all in the dark, but she gives in a performance, isn't she, on that song, which is just extraordinary, you know, like that way she brings that.
Yeah, and on a lot of the songs she gives these kind of very... coming in from an angle, not so, she's not like a straight up soul singer.
No, not at all, no.
There's something a bit Kate Bush about it, or,
course,
you know,
avant-garde. Sleazy in a good way, yeah,
almost,
totally.
You know that there's no way she's not aware of what she's doing.
No, no. So
and
exactly.
so there's two playing that game when they're working together. But he did, yeah. You know, he's just astonishing records. It can't just be serendipity. No. Oh, I only had this gear and therefore that's why it came out sounding like this. No.
But I know exactly what you're saying. I was surprised when I heard the comeback music and I heard him DJing in a couple of clubs.
But he's it's huge, so therefore
if
it's good.
Back and played all that original stuff, people would have gone nuts. That's but it's hard for people who want
to
keep moving on.
I said to him in the meeting, I was like, oh, you know, some dance music can be, you know, really, really uplifting. It's kind of like what I was saying to you, that you get this, you can get a juxtaposition in disco or dance music or club music, whatever, between this kind of unifying aspect.
Yeah.
The physical unifying aspect of it, of the formula.
Yeah.
And then complex emotions on top of that. So sometimes emotions that like are sad.
Yeah.
Emotions about being disconnected,
sure.
About you know, the opposite emotion to unity and uplift.
Absolutely, yeah.
And they live together in some kind of jarring harmony.
Is a great example of that, isn't it? You know, like really beautiful.
And I was trying to explain this to him, and he was just going, "No, I don't know what you're talking about." And I was going, "You do know what I'm talking about." He's going, "No, I have no clue what you're saying."
At least you try.
He probably is talking more sense than me, though. Yeah. In the end, let's face it. I love Sylvester.
Yeah, great, amazing. Aww. Yeah. And I guess
I was reading somebody the other day talking about him. They were saying he'd be a superstar today.
Yeah.
He'd literally be a superstar.
He would, yeah.
But
yeah.
What he had to fight against, the
amazing.
Battle of what it was to be him. Right? What's the name of the, do you know what the name of this film is? Is it a new documentary?
No, it's a radio documentary.
Oh.
So it's just right up there, yeah. I think it's on the BBC somewhere. So you just went on there, you find it, yeah.
Yes.
I'm not sure I'm allowed to mention that, but yeah.
In the beep, darling.
All right.
So let's move on to, have you got any Chris Rea?
Yes. We sort of had to mention this because, like, this goes back to, like, why I kind of got into music in the first place in a way was... So Harvey, who's the kind of... He's the kind of god of DJs, started all in Cambridge, really.
The
so
god of DJs.
For us.
But you give it all.
For us, for Cambridge, he was one that made it feel possible that a guy could come from Cambridge and actually get a career.
He's got a big enough head as it is, you know.
No,
he doesn't want to hear you calling him god.
Right. I don't want to say that, but I meant in terms of, like, he was older than us and he was the guy that when we were 17, 18, he was actually doing it, you know.
Yes.
And so we go down to Brighton and go to the Zap Club and see him play. Because if you grow up in Cambridge and you play in your local nightclub amongst your friends, you never think that this is going to lead to anything. It's just a thing you're doing. And then something comes out
Not then. I think the kids do
now.
And
a guy comes
now.
Out of your town and he's DJing in London. That's why I mean, that's the God thing, you know. And also what I love about him is actually he can be a brilliant DJ and he will also be quite loose. You know, I like the fact you never quite know what you're going to get with him.
Yeah.
But he made this song, La Version Française, which is Chris Rea. Apparently, I was obviously never there when it happened. Everyone says he dropped this, you know, in Ibiza, and it became this Balearic anthem.
Yes.
And that is probably all horseshit, but the legend is that Harvey started this one. So it makes sense for me to pick this tune because he's sort of, you know, go back to the Tummy Touch days. Our first 12 on Tummy Touch, I went down to a club in Shoreditch, probably not even there anymore, the old Mother Bar, and he was DJing there and he played that tune. We'd just done M Too Many, like, you know.
Oh, amazing.
And that was like
that was one of the moments.
You want to know, like, moments of my career, like Harvey playing one of my tunes in a club was like, and me and Andrew, suddenly it takes a while when you're not expecting it to recognise one of your own tunes because, you know, you think, am I dreaming now? Is this actually happening? And you're surrounded. And it's a lovely moment because nobody knows you've written this tune.
Mm-hmm.
So you get this really kind of honest appraisal of whether this tune's happening.
Whether it works or not. I mean, that's also something about dance music, isn't it?
Yeah,
also
it is. Yeah, it's brilliant,
That we were used to doing in the old days. People used to press acetates
and
bring them
out.
Down to the club and play them and then just... And that's what I was explaining to you was going on between me and Maurice Fulton too. It was like, can we change this? Can we change that? No, because I played it in the club and it works.
Yeah, exactly.
End of story. And it's
that.
A great filter in the end. It's no better filter.
Yeah.
Going back to, I have a T-shirt that I got in, somebody printed up for me, Leo Mass, actually. He made a set of T-shirts that said, got any Chris Rea? Because it's a real Balearic thing.
It is,
Chris Rea. Well, obviously... On the beach, there's a bit of Groove Armada DNA.
Yeah,
the DNA from
totally.
That is in Groove
and all
Armada.
All those changes and stuff. And that's you know, that when we do these little bar gigs we do in Ibiza sometimes, we get lucky enough to do those like, proper kind of Balearic-y vibes. Everyone's there in their white shirts.
Lovely.
Those are the best gigs, you know.
Okay, and then we just wanted to talk about, just for tonight, a Groove Armada track. Why did you choose that?
Just because, I mean, you remember actually one of the one times when we did do the songwriting thing, you know, and we tried to do this thing. We were obsessed with Fleetwood Mac at the time. And we were talking earlier about whether you bring, when you bring people into the studio and the different energy it brings. And actually, it's always good, you know, if you can tolerate it, and, you know, then, and with that one, we wrote with our guitar player, George, and he had this crazy guitar technique where you mic up a lead guitar, you don't plug it in. Mm. And that sound, that jangly sound that we get out of the real classic Fleetwood Mac sound, that's all over that track. And it's just, he's a real student. So it's fun. You know, there's, you know, I'm not massive into that stuff, but when you come across those techniques and they work, it's like,
yeah,
it's quite a thing, you know? So that's one of those songs that I, one of those rare songs of ours that I go back to and listen to and take real pride in, yeah.
Can I just ask you one thing else before you go? Because
yeah.
I mean, I've really enjoyed my chat with you,
yeah,
by the way.
Great.
It's been lovely. But just going back to club culture, did you ever think that you... And thinking about Harvey is what made me want to... Because I went to a Harvey gig at the Ministry of Sound a few years ago, and it was wall-to-wall middle-aged people.
Yeah, yeah.
So what do you make of that? I mean, coming from... You were 16-year-old when you started, and it was a new form in a way, even the whole way people were clubbing.
Totally.
Nightlife in that way, especially in the UK, brand new to us.
Yeah.
And now we can go to Harvey night and just be like all 40-year-olds
totally. I mean,
together. How do you find that?
When I was, if you told me when I was 22 that that would be happening, I'd be like, there's no way I'd be doing that, you know? And actually, I think it's really nice that the dance music's managed to evolve to such an extent. There's just such a broad church now, you know, that you don't have to, it doesn't have to be about just getting on one in a sweaty basement listening to tech house. You know, I love the fact that they can do that. And, you know, some nights are doing it better than others, but I'm sort of fine with it now, you know. I thought at some point I was going to get to 40 and start listening to classical music, but it just hasn't happened.
It's just not going to happen, is it? We're never going to give up, are
no.
we?
No, that's the truth.
And with that, I shall say good night.
Yeah. All right. Pleasure.
To get your hands on tickets to the hottest gigs and festivals, visit heinekenmusic.ie. Heineken, live your music. Enjoy Heineken responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie.